Hello there, IELTS students. Welcome to IELTS Podcast. You no longer have to worry, fret, or panic about IELTS because we are here to guide you through this test jungle. Enjoy these IELTS tutorials, and if you need more help or want to access the famous online course, you can visit us at IELTSpodcast.com.
Hello, it's me again, Rob Buckingham. How are you all? Listening in there, all you IELTS takers out there. It's me all by myself today. Ben's not with us, but here goes. I want to come on talking to you about speaking tests, part three. And the title of my talk today is, Why should I enjoy answering those tricky part three IELTS speaking test questions? Those difficult questions we may get in the last part of the test. But hey, wait a minute, before I go on, Ben was talking to me the other day about something really exciting I want to share with you. He's saying that the on the IELTSpodcast.com website, there's something new. It's a free IELTS mini writing course. Shall I say that word free again? It's free. A mini writing course. You know that not only speaking, but the writing parts of the test are probably for almost all of us the most difficult bits. So this sounds really good. You get feedback, instant feedback. You just send in your stuff and you get expert feedback as in return. I think this is really going to be good. So check that out. Go to IELTSpodcast.com and check out the free mini writing course. Okay, let's go back to what I was talking about, speaking. Let's go back to the speaking, part three speaking of the test. You know, if you really like the idea, of course you like the idea, of getting at least a 7 in the speaking test, then of course you should enjoy dealing with difficult questions. Why? I'll tell you why. It means that the examiner sees you as a strong candidate, someone that could and should be able to respond to questions using complex grammatical structures and showing that your knowledge and use of vocabulary is sufficiently wide enough to allow you to let you talk about a whole range of topics and sufficiently deep enough to be able to use specialized vocabulary when you need to. Okay, let's put all this in very simple arithmetic terms. I'm a simple kind of guy. I like to see it simply. Listen to this. Please remember that the examiner has the examiner's guide right there on the table during the exam. Your booklet, the one you've got that he's handed to you to prepare for part two, was opened just at one page, and you can see just the title and the subheadings. You know, the what, the where, when, why, and how, those kind of markers to help you plan and give your solo 2-minute talk. But the examiner has an extra page containing all kinds of possibilities for part three. Okay, what kind of possibilities? Well, for example, you know that in part three, for the examiner at least, it's the first time that the test becomes a little more open. Because in parts one and two, the examiner is just reading from a script, has no freedom, can't say what they feel like saying, can't join in any conversation with you. In part three, it's a bit different. Although maybe at first it doesn't appear to be the case because, you know, the examiner is just reading or just knows by heart after saying it so many times over the years. So it's not really reading. The introduction to part three. And as soon as he or she says, well, you've been talking about blah, 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 and I'd like to discuss with you one or two more general questions related to this. From the moment of that well, the stopwatch starts the countdown. The final 5 minutes of the test has started. 5 minutes of discussion. Examiner speaking time. Test taker speaking time. Of course, yes. The examiner should speak less than the test taker. Just ask the questions. And although some questions might be quite long and also involve some kind of, you know, introduction, some kind of preamble, if you like, the fact remains that the test taker will probably be answering questions, talking for around, shall we say, 3 minutes at least? 3 minutes? How many questions? Depends, of course. The examiner has or sees 3 sets of possible questions, each set with a possible or maybe maximum of 4 questions, or rather, not real questions, but kind of bullet point headers to give the examiner, you know, some kind of idea of what kind of questions he or she could ask. Doesn't have to be those things word for word, but more or less those topics. I'm asking myself, and I'm asking you as well, why 3 sets of questions? And does the examiner try to ask questions from all 3 sets? And would the questions come in that same strict order? Oh, so many questions, too many questions, I can't answer all these questions. Let's just say that the 3 sets go from the more straightforward, factual type in set 1 to the more speculative and argumentative in set 3, with set 2 somewhere in between. Now, the idea behind all this is for the examiner to choose 2 of the 3 sets. Not 3, just 2 out of 3, maximum. Quite simply, the slightly easier set 1 questions, followed by some from set 2, are for those candidates the examiner thinks are not so strong and would therefore benefit from the chance to show their skills at describing and comparing things, instead of using more difficult kind of speculative or hypothetical language that you might need to fully answer questions from set 3. To put that the other way around, for the candidate the examiner believes might be heading for at least an overall 7 in speaking, 7, 7.5, 8, you know, questions will begin with set 2 and then go on to set 3. So that's why the title I chose today is all about how you should feel if you're on the receiving end of these more challenging questions. You'll think, hey, I'm doing okay. I'm heading for a 7, but wait a minute, I've got to justify this, because in part 3, it's when the examiner really makes up his or her mind. Is this really a 7? Was what I thought before true? Is this just confirming that? Or, I'm a little bit disappointed, maybe it's, this candidate is not quite as good as I thought, because the language he or she is using is not so complex, not so elaborate. Let's see. It doesn't make anything any easier for you, does it? I mean, let me give you an example. It's a recent example about somebody that I know, actually. It's a former student of mine, an ex-student of mine. She recently took IELTS. I expected her to get a very good band score in everything. She had to get an overall kind of 7, I think it was, to be accepted on a postgraduate course she was aiming for. And more than that, it had to be, I think, at least a kind of 6.5 or 7, I can't remember exactly, in each of the 4 areas. Reading, listening, writing, and speaking. Pretty tough, huh? Well, okay, I'll cut it right to the chase, as they say. No more suspense. She did it. She made it. With higher grades than 7 in both reading, listening, and speaking. And she did make it also in the writing. Yeah, she just about made it in all of them. Yeah, she got a 7 in speaking. She got a 7 in speaking. She got a better result in reading and listening, and did pretty well in writing too. But she made it. Congratulations to her. I mean, I thought, to be honest, that she should have got or would have got a higher grade in speaking. I mean, could have, should have. might have, if the sun was shining that day on a perfect day, if she'd had a good breakfast or whatever. You know, things cannot be guaranteed, can they? And chatting with her a little while after the exam, she told me that the speaking test was going really well until part three, when she thought she lost her way a little bit. I mean, I tell you what happened. In part two, the topic she was given was something like, describe a time when you spent more money than you expected. And she told me, she talked about a recent event when she was hosting some kind of dinner in a restaurant, some kind of work thing that she had to organize, you know, and to host. And the restaurant tried to overcharge her by a considerable amount of money, but that she succeeded in making the complaint with the management and the issue was resolved. Not exactly happily, but, you know, it was all solved in the end. No problems. I'm only retelling what she told me because it seems to me that, to be honest, she did a pretty good job, a great job of kind of twisting the title of the topic to her own advantage, you know, with a very or fairly dramatic kind of personal anecdote, which was good. She was talking about real experiences, giving real examples. And, you know, it was a time when they tried to make her spend more than she expected. She knew what the price was and they tried to overcharge her. That's fair enough. Now, what I gather from what she told me about the part three questions she was asked, it appears that the examiner thought she was very capable of handling these more speculative, tougher questions, since he didn't get into any of the set one style questions, you know, the type that would go something like, what do people in your country often spend a lot of money on? You know, those kind of easier ones to ease you into a discussion when you can simply make a list or describe or compare different things. I mean, maybe a question could be, do you think that younger people tend to spend more money on luxury goods than older people, or something like that. No, I don't know. I'd have to see for myself the examiner booklet to see what kind of questions they would ask, but it would be something like that to begin with in set one. Well, okay. In fact, she told me that the examiner started out maybe with a set two and you know, a few questions on the issues of teaching children to value what they have. Something along the lines of, I think it was, should children be taught to value their possessions and the effort it takes to buy them? And another one might be, I think it was, is it important to help those less fortunate than ourselves? And should parents teach their children to do that? I mean, you know, I don't know how you'd say that, like doing charity work or helping poor people. I don't know. And then the examiner switched to a more difficult set of questions. It was something like this, about the possible responsibilities of people with money, of the wealthy, and of governments. The questions were something like, is it the responsibility of governments to ensure that wealth is fairly distributed between people? Oh my God, you'd have to think about that a couple of times before you'd even could answer anything there, no? Distributing wealth amongst society, the responsibility of government. And the other question was something like, to what extent should the rich help the poor? I mean, in this particular case and this particular context, I think this ex-student of mine was taken a bit by surprise. Tell you why. It wasn't the fact that she knew very little about the topic or didn't have the language skills, the grammar and the vocabulary to handle the questions. Quite the opposite, in fact. I mean, she's aiming to do, and she will do, I'm sure, a master's in the area of economics and has her first degree in economics. So it was more of a case, I think, of her thinking, hey, are you being serious? Do you think I can answer that in a few seconds? I could talk about this for hours. I mean, for a start, Mr. Examiner, what exactly do you mean when you say rich, poor, responsibility? And please don't ask me to talk about the government. Oh, my God. I mean, it's one of these things, isn't it? It could happen to any of us. Think of yourself. I'm thinking of myself. Think about a subject that you know very well. How do you deal with a question that obviously comes from someone who knows much less than you do about the same thing? Very little, in fact. I mean, yeah, I guess we can, and maybe we should, give a simple enough answer. And I guess we do in real life, don't we, if we're being nice and polite. But in an exam, she was nervous. It was an important exam for her. And she said, yeah, I began to feel a bit nervous. And she's not the nervous type of person, believe me. I mean, she told me that she hesitated a bit and gave an answer that, in her opinion, didn't really cover very much. It was as if she was trying to get onto the next question with a superficial kind of, yes, I think the rich should help those less well off, and they do to some extent by paying higher government taxes, which go, well, theoretically at least, to finance social programs and help the unemployed and so on. End of story. Thank you and goodbye. Yep. She could have added a lot more, I think. And I guess that's why she ended up in speaking with a 7, which was very good. No complaints. But really, she could have got an 8, in my opinion. So no harm done in the end with her. But it could happen to any of us, no? I mean, for me, from all of this, perhaps the message is use those more tricky questions to try to put together a few connected thoughts. They want you to extend your answer as much as possible. It's an English test, remember. Not a test of knowledge or the depth of your intellect. You don't have to think the same way as the examiner. You don't have to have read 100 books to be able to answer the questions. It's all to do with how you put it together in English. Luckily for me, that, because if I'm going to try to answer that question and think about what I would have said, my knowledge is pretty limited when it comes to economics. I think it's pretty much restricted to the supermarket checkout time. You know, how much is it? Thank you very much. Bye. Let me see. I've made a few mental notes. I'm going to leave you this today with this one, and we'll come back to this maybe in my next podcast. I'd like to go on with some more details on this, but these are my mental notes about that kind of question, the idea of should governments be responsible for, you know, making sure that wealth or money, if you like, is distributed a little bit more fairly amongst the different sectors of society. Okay, let me think. I've got this. One, any government has to make sure the economy is doing okay, that it runs well. Yeah, I think so. No, if the economy is good, the people are happy in general. It's good also because in any economy, if people with less money, if poor people can't spend money because they can't spend anything extra than just the bare stuff on food and stuff, that's also bad for everybody. It's bad for the rich, isn't it? Because, you know, if they're not buying things that the rich people make or something, I mean, the rich people are not going to make any money. So it's in to the benefit of both sides. So, of course, at the same time, governments can get money, they can raise money on luxury items, being the better paid, and using a lot of that money, a lot of that revenue to finance social programs such as educational training, retraining, maybe opening new job opportunities, I don't know. And how can I give an example of that to justify all that? I said, you know, it's to benefit both sides. Hey, wait a minute, I got it. Any attempt you know, to reduce differences between groups in society, if we're thinking about how much money people have, for example, must be good. I mean, look at those countries that they have when they publish. I think I read it recently. What they call a worldwide happiness index. They do these surveys in different countries, asking people how happy they feel. Who came out on top this year or last year? Finland. Who are in the top 10 or the top 15 countries? Always the Scandinavian countries. And I include Iceland there, you know, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, as well, of course, as Finland. They seem to be happier. You're thinking to yourself, why should they be happy? It's freezing cold there. And I don't think, I think only did Denmark get to the World Cup? I think so. I'm not sure, actually. I think they did. But the other countries are not even in the Football World Cup. So what are they celebrating? Well, I've read they're happier because they don't feel that there's a great big huge difference between the rich and the poor, and that the money that they pay in tax to the governments use it for the people's benefit. So, hey, that makes people happier. They feel, yeah, it's okay here because, you know, it's not perfect, but... So this must be a good idea. Well, those are just my ideas. That's what I would think of saying anyway. So that's all for now. Hey, let me remind you before I go about that IELTS mini course, the writing course. You know, it's not speaking, writing. It's a free thing. It's a new thing. It's coming now. It's there already. Get into IELTSpodcast.com and you can online get into the free IELTS mini writing course and receive feedback for free, expert feedback on any kind of writing that you do. Okay, so do that, get in there, it'd be well worth it. Enjoy it, make the most of it while the time is right before you take that exam. All right, that's all for today. Have a good time, have a good week, enjoy yourselves, don't work too hard, be good and be happy. Okay, bye bye for now.
IELTSpodcast.com.